Good afternoon. You're listening to Planet Radio 88 FM. My name is Kate Conroy, and you're listening to a new show, A Climate Affair. It is going to be a current affairs show that's going to talk about environmental issues as they happen in Brisbane, in our communities, in Queensland, in Australia, and ultimately around the planet, because we're all part of the one planet. So we need to be really conscious of how individually we act in ways that affect everyone. So who am I? What's this show and how is it all going to pan out? Well, I've come to Planet Radio over in the last couple of months, and I've moved recently from Montreal, Canada, which it is currently about negative 20 degrees centigrade. So a very cold place to be living, and Brisbane is quite a contrast. I'm a graduate student in philosophy, and so in the course of doing a philosophy degree, a lot of what we study are the ethics of the way we act and why we act and how we can lead better lives. And through thinking about life philosophically, I've come to think about the way I behave in my environment, and I'm interested in those issues. I've also been a yoga student for 4 years, so I may bring to this show a yogic perspective, hopefully, and I will offer a little tips for relaxation and meditation along the way, because Planet Radio is about the environment, but it's also about ourselves and how we can become more in touch with our inner spirituality and our own sense of the right way to be. So here we are. Welcome to the show. I'd like to dedicate my first show to my husband, Morgan, for being such an inspiration. I think he's listening right now. So this is for you, darling, and I hope everyone is having a great time. You're listening to Planet Radio 88 FM. You're also listening to Kate Conroy on A Climate Affair, a new program on environmental news and current affairs. So what are the issues that people are thinking about in the environment today? Probably the most dramatic change has been the introduction of the recycled water controversy. So our Premier has decided that Brisbane will have to move to recycled water as soon as 2008. And that's the city drinking water in Brisbane and in most of southeast Queensland. And recycled water will be coming through our mains water, and it will be coming through our taps. So it will not be separately piped to your home. You will actually be drinking it from your tap. And this is making a lot of people upset. They are concerned, they are worried. The initial thought of drinking recycled water can make people feel quite disgusted, even if they're not sure why that is. So it's a very important issue. It's important to think carefully about your own emotions to it, because sometimes our emotions can lead us to worry about things that actually rationally we should be very unconcerned by. So one of the main issues with recycled water is probably to get the facts straight. I mean, what actually is recycled water? On the most vulgar level, I suppose it's recycled raw sewage. So that might make one feel, oh dear, that could be a bit unpleasant. What if they don't filter it correctly? Am I going to be drinking something that really I ought to not be drinking? Well, I wanted to know answers to these questions as well, because I have to confess, I didn't know how recycled water really was created. What were the processes? So let's have a look. What happens when wastewater is recycled is you get a combination of reverse osmosis and disinfection with ultraviolet radiation. That's the most common method. And in reverse osmosis, water is forced through a very fine membrane that filters out salts and other matter, but it lets water molecules pass through. Now, I sort of thought maybe, you know, there'd be some form of evaporative system, you know, so the wastewater would be on one level and the water molecules would sort of go up and hit, a plastic top and then be filtered away. And I thought, oh, well, that's good because, you know, water can evaporate and it'll be pure molecules and the gunk will be left behind. So that'll be great. Osmosis, you know, I think, well, what if, you know, what are the equipment like? What if the equipment doesn't quite filter it out properly? So I still find myself in a state of concern when I hear about this. Nevertheless, How recent is this technology for creating recycled water? Is this a big experiment that nowhere else in the world has ever thought about? Well, actually, I've got a personal connection to recycled water because my grandfather was a great hydrologist, Crawford Munro, and he was one of the first hydrologists in the world, let alone Australia. And there's a photo of him drinking recycled water back in the 1960s. So the technology has been here for a long time, but the political acceptability of the idea has not. Not only that, but there's a lot of countries in the world that utilise recycled water. So, for example, Singapore opened two sewage recycling plants in 2003, and what they do is they add the treated water to its reservoirs, and they provide only about 1% of the island's total daily water consumption. Nevertheless, it is part of what they do. Also, the Greater London, even though it doesn't formally add wastewater to its potable supply, however, 13 million residents joke that their water has already been through five people before coming out of the tap because towns upstream, such as Oxford and Reading, discharge their treated sewage into the River Thames. So the idea of bringing back into our familiar water supply treated sewage is quite familiar in London. And if you're a Sydney sider, you'll know for a long time Sydney has been discharging its sewage into the oceans. And back in the 70s, that discharge actually wasn't treated very well. And of course, Sydney siders would sometimes get sick because they would actually suffer from illnesses associated with the filthy water. Since then, Sydney has made a huge effort to make sure that their effluent is correctly treated, and now no one seems to complain, and certainly the water quality seems very good. So these things, this recycled water concept, is not actually a new one, nor is Australia somehow the guinea pig here. What Australia has, I think, at the moment is this amazing opportunity to be on the forefront of the revolution in the way the world perceives its water and perceives its own existence. We're a Western country. We have the money and the education to make substantial infrastructure changes. And, you know, we can use those technological advances to influence the rest of the world. So in the same way that the Dutch, for example, are incredible engineers with their dikes and waterways, and they are leaders in the world in levees and in a lot of water construction and environmental developments, Australia too could be on the forefront of engineering to do with hydrology. And that's exciting. I think that's exciting. And I think it's important for there to be an upside and for people to have hope, because in the light of the drought that is now 6 years long, in light of global warming, with a lot of the issues that we're facing, it can sometimes feel so overwhelming that we don't know how to really broach them or how to see hope for the future. And I think taking strength in this amazing scientific background that we have in Australia and our ability to export knowledge to the world, not just raw produce, is a real key to feeling better about our situation and about our future. So that's just a little bit about recycled water, and you're listening to Planet Radio 88 FM. I'm Kate Conroy. This is A Climate Affair, and I'm going to put on some Elton John, Your Song. Planet Radio 88 FM. You're listening to A Climate Affair with Kate Conroy. It is now 4:17 p.m. I hope your day is a good one. So I'd like to stop the program for a moment of its intellectual variety and encourage everyone to take a moment to take a nice deep breath. Take a nice deep breath, because it's the afternoon and a few good breaths are as good as a cup of coffee. If you're feeling a little tired, a little stressed, a little like you might have had enough and you're ready to go home, take a moment to take a deep breath and realize that you're already home right now in the now. That you don't actually have to be located anywhere else to be comfortable where you are. That home is what we think about when we think of peace and comfort and protection. But through a deep breath, we can find peace, we can find quiet, and we can find protection against what we feel is going on in the world that causes us stress. Those deep breaths, bringing your oxygen into the body, because at least in our current world, in Australia and in Brisbane, we still have plenty of oxygen in our air, and currently it's free. So make the most of it. Your body utilizes oxygen as much as it utilizes the food that you eat. So make sure you get enough today and feel better about what you're up to. Okay, so let's get back into the recycled water issue. So not only are there a lot of countries in the world who have been adding recycled water to their water for a long time, or have been, accessing the technology, it's been used in watering parks and golf courses for decades. I mean, this stuff has been pumped to those areas non-controversially for a long time. So it's a little strange that we don't already have a comprehensive water recycling program for our parks and waterways. I think that the Botanical Gardens in Melbourne utilise recycled water, and the Roma Street Gardens just down the road also utilise recycled water. And what a blessing it is to be able to go to those gardens in the middle of a drought situation and enjoy the greenness of the grass and the lushness of the vegetation. I actually am going to take a moment to talk about the Roma Street Gardens, because I think they're an amazing initiative and they are a beautiful place to visit. It's one of the largest, I think it is the largest subtropical garden in any major city in the world. And if you've not experienced the native vegetation of the southeast Queensland because of all of the development that has surrounded us, then you might appreciate seeing some of the species that were in abundance before white people really came in and trashed the joint. Native vegetation is absolutely miraculous, and I was blown away. I found it just exquisite. There's also water features and lizards and a lot of information if you go to the gardens. So it's a great place to take yourself or your family, to have a picnic, to have a rest and a recuperation. And it's right near the Roma Street station, and it was actually built by the government about seven years ago. So now the garden's really starting to take shape. So I'm sure we should appreciate a lot of the public parks and things that are available to us a lot more than we do. And best of all, it's free. So beauty and free. What else can you ask for? So yes, recycled water utilised in some of our parks and starting to be utilised more. So what are the downsides, if any, to recycled water? Well, as we've already talked about, there's a psychological yuck factor of drinking former sewage. Apparently also this sort of water purification actually uses quite a lot of energy. And there's also some environmental issues about the disposal of the concentrated salty wastewater byproduct. So these are things to consider. If you look at any form of water project, whether it's desalination projects turning seawater into drinkable water, or if you're taking recycled water from raw sewage and turning it into drinkable water, these all require substantial amounts of energy. So in a situation we're in now, where most of our energy comes from fossil fuel burning, such as coal, perhaps we do want to reconsider recycled water. Perhaps there's a better way. What would that way be? Well, it's interesting. In the past, Australians didn't use so much mains water. When my parents were growing up, they utilised water tanks, and water tanks were the main way to get your household water. Now, in some parts of Australia, the most industrial parts, perhaps water tanks are a problem because of pollutants that come from the rainwater falling down onto your roof. Nevertheless, most people, especially those in the suburbs and in the ever-expanding urban sprawl, could use rainwater tanks without problem and without excess pollutants at all. These water tanks are fairly cheap in the scale of energy required for the installation and the longevity of the tanks themselves. There's a subsidy by all of the state governments for anyone interested in installing water tanks. And you have the wonderful sense of satisfaction, which is that you don't let any of our precious rainwater go to waste. And if you've been in Brisbane for the past few weeks, you'll notice that even though we get rain in the city, the government keeps saying that we don't get rain in the catchment areas. That's an important thing to recognise, that all this water is falling where we're living, and yet we're losing it, we're wasting it. But there's water that we're supposedly wanting to utilise that's going through the mountains, which it's not raining. So we don't have any rain at this distant location to be trucked in. We do have rain here, but we're not catching it because most people do not have rainwater tanks. So if you're in a situation to install a rainwater tank and you're interested in the feasibility of it financially, I recommend going to the Queensland Government websites. If you do have internet access, it's very easy to find them because you can simply write Queensland Water Government into Google or keywords of that type of nature, and you will come up with the Queensland websites. They have also incentives if you are interested in conserving water in your own home. They will get a plumber out to your property, and you only have to pay $20 instead of about $150 or $200 that normally a plumber's visit would cost. The plumber will come and fit an economical shower head for you, and will investigate other aspects of your water usage and advise you on how you can also increase your water savings. So there are practical things you can do. There are affordable things you can do to make a difference in our water crisis situation. You know, this is really empowering, and it's good to know that the government is helping people to become more responsible with their water. You're listening to Planet Radio 88 FM. I'm Kate Conroy, and this is A Climate Affair. So we've just been talking about recycled water and the way that recycled water is made and the environmental effects that it might have and how good it's probably going to be for Brisbane and possibly for Australia and eventually the rest of the world. So really the only question left to ask, I think, with the recycled water question is ultimately, what's the outcome for recycled water and whether you can taste the difference? Taste surveys have found that, look, most people can't tell the difference between tap, recycled and bottled water. Some people perhaps they can. I feel maybe on some good days I can tell the difference between a glass of Evian and tap water. I think I can taste that chlorine. Nevertheless, I'm pretty convinced that recycled water will taste better than ordinary tap water. Ordinary tap water comes from reservoirs, and those reservoirs are not places of lacking in contamination. They all get bird droppings. They all feature a lot of wildlife. They all feature all of the inherent problems of being a body of water dripping in from the soil. So there's some good minerals there, but there would probably be some minerals that you wouldn't necessarily want in your body. And indeed, in 2001, University of Southern Florida found that the microbiological quality of water from a wastewater treatment plant was actually much better than that from the local reservoir. So there you go. There's an intuition and there's some science to back it up. So recycled water looks like a good idea. Obviously, it's going to be energy intensive. Nevertheless, do we have a choice? We probably don't. Now, where are we going to get the money for this recycled water? Well, this is an interesting question, and it moves me on to the second topic I'd like to talk about today, and that's the federal government's taking over of the Murray River water catchment areas and to try and do a massive, massive overhaul of the way the entire country deals with our water. The percentages of the amount of total water used and the what industry requires varies depending on your newspaper that you look at. But I've read figures ranging from 70 to 90% of all water usage in Australia goes either to agriculture or mining. So changing agricultural practice seems to be a really key importance in making the water problem go away somewhat. Agriculture uses a vast amount of water. If anyone can explain to me why we're harvesting rice in Australia, please do call us up at Planet Radio and explain to me why we should be making rice. Rice is heavy. Rice can be grown in much better areas, and it requires an absolutely phenomenal amount of water. So if you're a vegetarian and you're eating Australian rice, you know, you're not contributing to our success, I'm afraid. Nevertheless, vegetarians should pat themselves on the back because they use less water than our meat-eating cousins. And I'll get more onto diet and its effect on the environment later. But yes, so the Murray River and the Darling, what's going on there and what are going to be the changes that the federal government's going to bring into play? I think I've seen a couple of things by Johnny Howard, our little Prime Minister, Mr. Sheen, over the last year, I think, where I've actually been very impressed with him. And this, you know, this is a long many years where I've disliked him. He's a funny looking guy, and obviously his policies are very liberal, which, you know, I'd like to bring a little bit of a kind of a lefty, ranty radio perspective to my show. And, you know, he has introduced all kinds of policies, like the industrial relations one last year, that seem absolutely dubious at best and disastrous at worst. Nevertheless, I've looked at the way he's responded to various issues recently, and it must be said he's an intelligent man. Not only is he an intelligent man, but he also has a perspective and a point of view. He's not afraid to point it, pull it across, and he's quite articulate. So his arguments are worth taking seriously. You know, he's not a bush. He's not a stupid guy. He's not someone who's a puppet of his government. He seems to run his own government. And at least I respect him for that. You know, I respect him for having a vision and following it through. So what's he doing with the environment, and what's he doing with this water scheme? It looks like he's going to put in about $10 billion of Australia's taxpayers' money into looking over the agricultural use of water and renegotiating a lot of the farms. So that's very exciting. I think really with water, it's such a fundamental, it really needs to be in control. The state needs to be in control of it, as in the federal government. You know, our water systems don't run by states. States are an arbitrary line divided, you know, politically back 100 years ago. You know, following New Zealand's lead is a great idea, if you ask me. New Zealand have changed their political boundaries based on water catchment areas. So if you're part of a particular political sphere, that's going to be shared with all other water users. I think that's a great idea. And so obviously we've got Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia all depending on this big multi-river system. And these are the biggest states population-wise in Australia. So I think the federal government has every right to say, look, we need to nationalise the use of water. We need to make sure that the people's jobs are protected and the environment's protected and that our future is protected. So one of the things they're going to do is they're going to institute covered agricultural irrigation channels. So currently an enormous amount of Australia has open ditch irrigation. What does that mean? Well, it is what it sounds like. You have open ditches running along farm areas from which the water flows from reservoirs, and it flows at normally a large flow, and it flows at an incredibly cheap cost to farmers. The government actually subsidises the growing of cotton in Australia. It costs the Australian government and Australian taxpayers more money than is generated in the cotton sales to produce cotton. There's so much farm subsidy in Australia in terms of water, it's absolutely shocking. You have no idea how uneconomical it is to be growing the things that we grow in Australia. By the way, Cheezels, our favourite snack, I only discovered recently. They're a wonderfully Australian product, 1971, going strong. Think they're tasty, contain real cheese. But they're made of Australian corn and Australian rice. Rice, I thought. Oh, no. I hope I don't have to boycott Cheezels. Poor old Cheezels. Poor old Australian rice. Let's not have it. Let's get rid of it. Let's put that offshore. We're not designed for it. We've got barren soils. We've got the oldest soils. Our soils are very salty. What we do have is plenty of minerals, and that's a different topic, whether we should be mining them. But we probably shouldn't be growing crops that aren't designed for them. So yes, the covered irrigation channels, that's going to make a huge difference in the efficiency of the water usage. Nevertheless, is that going to change the actual way that farmers grow crops? Is that going to change their habitual use of certain products on those fields? How far is this going to go in terms of really revolutionising Australia's agricultural industry? One of the discussions being taking place at the moment is to move agriculture north, to take agricultural industry away from that Murray River, Darling Basin area and have it in the Northern Territory or in far north Queensland. This again is another issue that my grandfather mentioned back in the 60s and 70s. He said that Australia was going to face a massive water shortage with the increasing population that it was experiencing at the time and has continued to experience ever since. He said that Adelaide would never be able to sustain a city. It would have to depopulate, and that looks like it may actually come true. And he said that what will have to happen is that the people will have to move north, that around the Townsville area, the Burdekin Valley, that's where people will have to live in Australia in order to have enough water. Cities must be based around a consistent water supply. That's one of the things they must have. And at the moment, Australia is looking a bit grim. looking a bit grim. There's been a lot of urban sprawl, a lot of people who utilize water in their daily life in a way that is not sustainable. We really can't afford to have excessive lawns in our backyards. The notion of having an English garden or, you know, depending on these agricultural practices from a different hemisphere, unfortunately, it's not going to work. We're not going to succeed if we have to live like that only by changing our expectations of our gardens and our own usage of water. Can we hope to live profitably in the future and for our children? So that's the Murray River Darling, the Murray Darling River system, excuse me, and how we might see some changes in the future. And if you're interested in buying property, maybe you should be buying property up north. Maybe that's where the money's going to be. Of course, there's a lot of concern up there by residents, by scientists, and by farmers about what kind of change that's going to mean for the far north. And one of the more disturbing aspects is that our Indigenous peoples have been given or returned that land to them. Is the government going to once again renege on a deal that was made? Because a lot of the land that's being discussed is under their jurisdiction. So anything that goes forward in the future must be not only carefully considered from a purely environmental / science perspective, but from the spiritual perspective of the original owners of the land and whether they are interested in having Western agricultural practices on that land. So it's a very difficult issue. It's going to be one fraught with debate and anxiety. Hopefully, we will see strong leadership from all sides and that really good, sustainable and sensitive practices will take place. I'm hoping that's the case. You're listening to Planet Radio, 88 FM. It's 4:42. You're listening to Kate Conroy on A Climate Affair. Hope you're having a terrific afternoon. We're discussing the latest issues and news that's going on in our world. You're listening to A Climate Affair with Kate Conroy. That was Radiohead, No Surprises, a great track from a number of years ago. Reminds me of heady days of youth, it does. So what's the next issue that I'd like to talk about today? Well, we've talked about water recycling. We've talked about bringing water recycling to Brisbane and what you can expect from it and what it probably is going to entail from a technological perspective. Now I'd like to talk about another feisty topic, and that's nuclear power. This is a huge topic in Australia right now, and there are constant developments and constant discussions going on from all quadrants of our society. The first thing that most people think about when they think of nuclear power is they think of Chernobyl. That's what I think. I think of nuclear disaster. I think of people suffering during the American bombing of Hiroshima. I think of nuclear power as the great mistake that Einstein wished he had never been a contributor. So that's my upbringing. I was brought up in the 80s and I was brought up in a time of the Cold War. The Cold War was very scary and people were in fear of a nuclear attack at all times. And today we have still the same fear when it comes to any country that has nuclear weapons. So nuclear represents a threat to our existence and it represents, I think, something very unnatural to people. And they fear that radiation, of course radiation will be fear-worthy, you should be fearful of it, could cause some terrible disease. So we fear leukemia if we're too close to sites of radiation. We fear having too many x-rays because they say in hospitals, you know, too many x-rays will increase your chances of various cancers. These are the rumours. I certainly won't be substantiating them today, but I can explain some of the emotional response we have, I think, to the nuclear reactor situation and the idea of more nuclear activity in Australia. Certainly, I was always fearful of microwaves because I thought, oh, microwaves, they're a scary thing I don't understand. So I never want to stand in front of them just in case they're going to cause me damage. So there is fear of perhaps the small things, the unknown, or things that have been talked about for so many years and that have been a part of our fear culture for a long time. So what do we do now when we've got an energy crisis on our hands and we've got the terror and the fear of global warming? How do we balance the fear of one to the fear of the other, and is there an alternative which won't involve any fear? So let's look at the positive arguments for nuclear energy and what kind of advantages it might have over what we're currently doing or in the long-term future of Australia's economy. I mean, why is there so much discussion going on right now? Certainly there's got to be some good arguments for it, otherwise we wouldn't have so many people talking. So let's go back to my favourite man, Johnny Howard, on the ground. Little Johnny Howard, Mr. Sheen, going to clean up our energy problems with a whisk and a dust brush. He suggests that we do go nuclear. He thinks this is a good idea. Well, here's one reason why Australia should go nuclear. Australia has 40% of the world's uranium. 40%, that's an enormous amount. I mean, we really have a country that has very poor soils, but the consequence of that is we have incredible amounts of mineral wealth. Out of the biggest mining companies in the world, Australia is responsible for two of them. So the biggest is Rio Tinto, based in the UK, and then there's BHP, and I believe Alcoa is the third. Correct me if I'm wrong. Both of the latter two are Australian. So what do we have that the other countries don't have? Well, we've already know that we have enormous amounts of gold, hence the gold rush in the late 19th century that made Melbourne so rich and so marvellous. And we have enormous amounts of uranium. We have enormous amounts of, what's the other thing in the soil? I've forgotten it right now. Titanium, that's the one. Apparently our beach soil, our beach sand is full of titanium. That's one of the precious minerals that everyone wants these days. We have aluminium, we have copper, we have vast amounts of coal. We've got streams of so many minerals in our soils. Obviously we have opals. The list goes on. And not only do we have these minerals, but we also seem to have an incredibly arid country. So we have a country which has a lack of vegetation across enormous parts of it. Obviously, we have desert ecosystems, and we should value those ecosystems, for even though humans may not appreciate them, a lot of animals and plants of a unique character live there. So I certainly am not going to advocate that we just dig up the entire country. But I think that if we do have minerals in particularly unfertile and unutilized and, you know, parts of Australia, perhaps mining isn't such a terrible idea. It certainly doesn't scare me as much as forestry scares me and the destruction of the Tasmanian old growth forests. I think the cutting down of our native timber is absolutely terrifying. Our soils are so delicate that those processes, it's not sustainable. We might as well think of the timber industry as being like mining. You know, once we've got rid of those old trees, that's it. It's all over. We won't be able to grow most of them back, and we will certainly lose the amazing flora and fauna that come with those forests. So I'm much more concerned about forestry than I am about certain forms of mining. And the other thing about mining is we live in a very geologically stable continent. So a lot of places in the world that have nuclear reactors are places which are very volatile, as in they might suffer from an earthquake or they might suffer from seismic activity of other kinds. And so they're, you know, in a absolutely volatile environmental situation. Australia is in a great situation from that perspective, because there are very stable places where we could bury waste, nuclear waste. So if we did, you know, institute nuclear power, we could actually dispose of that waste very easily. Of course, there's the political problem, but political problems aside, what's the actual issues with dumping this stuff out in the middle of nowhere? Not many. But of course, again, it's such a volatile topic that it's hard to think rationally about it, because we fear having more of this sort of activity in our country. But here we are with 40% of the world's uranium, and currently we actually sell this uranium to many different countries. So we've been selling uranium to China for a long time, and we'll continue to do so. China has a no nuclear weapons program, so that's one justification. Australia has an official policy of not selling uranium for weapons use. Nevertheless, Australia's been selling uranium to the United States of America for many years. And the United States, as we all know, is one of the biggest producers of nuclear weapons. So there's a lot of hypocrisy in Australia's policies, and Australia, like many other countries around the world, if not every country, is a hypocrite when it comes to dealing with their own policies, because they want to protect themselves, their businesses and their people, and often they'll do almost anything to do so, even if it violates moral principles. So that's what Australia currently does. We're already shipping this stuff overseas. And the question for me sometimes is, are we going to continue to be an economy which doesn't do anything with our raw materials? Are we going to continue, for example, to ship virgin old-growth forests from Tasmania to Japan as wood chips and then buy them back from Japan at, you know, 1,000 times what we sold them to Japan for. So we sell, you know, a ton of wood chips for about $100 to Japan, and they sell it back to us as paper for $2,000 a ton. Like, it's amazing. Now, those figures, I've pulled them a little bit from the rear end. Nevertheless, there is a massive disparity between the costs of these things. And the question is, if we're going to rape and pillage our own land, either the timber or the minerals, isn't it better for us to also benefit from turning them into something that's worth a lot of money? So why don't we have more industry in Australia? Why are we not do things here and then make a better profit to get stuff overseas? And, you know, if people make better profits, then there's an opportunity to institute more environmentally friendly practices, you know? I mean, that, maybe that's optimistic, but this is one way, you know, to make Australia stronger, is to make it more profitable. So if we have these minerals and we're going to mine them out of the ground anyway, isn't it better that we turn our raw copper or our raw silver, our gold, our titanium, you know, isn't it better if we're going to mine that stuff out of the ground anyway for us to utilize it to help us?
Please join me in the Inspiration Lounge this Friday morning on Planet Radio. The show features positive music, interviews with inspiring people, and a live meditation experience. The Inspiration Lounge with Andy Travis, 9 till noon Fridays on Planet 88 FM.
You're listening, as Andy just said, to Planet Radio 88 FM, and the Inspiration Lounge will be on tomorrow, and I highly recommend that you tune in for it. For if you're enjoying me today, just wait till you hear what Andy will have on his show. He's always got amazing guests and things that are worth listening to, and also a time to relax and meditate and to enjoy your day just a little bit better. We've got such a great team of people here at Planet, you have no idea. If you're interested in helping out at all, you should come down and see us. We're just here in Fortitude Valley. We're in this wonderful old church. I feel like it's a good spiritual place to be, and I think that the job's being done here for the value of all. So if you're interested in helping out, you should come down. If you're interested in doing anything with Planet Radio, you're likely to get at least a good ear to listen to your ideas and see where they go. So you're listening to A Climate Affair. It's a new show on Planet Radio. I'm Kate Conroy, and I'm talking about current issues in the environment debate, and I'm talking about things that are affecting us today. So far on the show, we've talked about the recycled water bill that's come in and is going to change Brisbane water forever next year. And we've also talked about the new $10 billion federal government money that's going to go towards changing agriculture in Australia and covering irrigation ditches. It's going to be a huge change in what farmers currently do in their land, and it's going to make a huge change in Australia's economy. So that's going to be very, very interesting to watch as it develops. And the third thing that Australia's doing, which is causing a ruckus, and that's nuclear energy. And a lot of people are very upset, and a lot of people are very indignant. The indignant people say, well, we've got to move to nuclear energy and we've got to do it now. And the people who are against it say, what are you thinking? That is the stupidest idea I've ever heard. Why don't we do other things? So I've already talked about the possible positives of nuclear power in Australia. One is that we have an enormous amount of uranium in the soil. The other is that our continent is geologically very stable. And the third one is that, what's the third one? It's got to be more than two, surely. All right, I'll have to come back to that. So what are the possible disadvantages of nuclear power? How is that going to affect us in a negative way? Well, one of the things that have come about with nuclear power is, what are the full cost of adopting this in Australia? What's it going to be? Do we know realistically how much it's going to cost us in pure economic terms, forgetting for the moment any of the issues towards the toxicity of the output or the danger to ourselves? It could probably be several hundred million dollars. That's the likely figure. And it's possible that it will go even higher, because there's a history of cost blowouts in plant construction, decommissioning, and waste storage. So if you look at the use of nuclear power around the world, we can actually take some lessons about what might happen to Australia when we build these facilities, and what's going to happen when we try to decommission them in the future. There isn't a good track record in even the most successful businesses that create nuclear power reactors. So there's no guaranteed costs and construction timetables, and you know, other costs associated with the industry are probably going to be passed from industry to taxpayers, so from current to future generations. So we're looking at an uncertain amount of money, several hundred billion dollars at least, and we don't even know if that's a realistic estimate because we actually don't understand the real cost of maintaining and decommissioning these nuclear reactors when we're done with them. So what has the federal government suggested is going to be the cost? Well, last year, the federal government said it's going to cost $75 billion to institute a nuclear reactor program in Australia, and that's only for 25 nuclear power plants. This seems like an understatement. So there's a lot of criticism of the federal government just for the costs that they're suggesting for introducing nuclear power. And the nuclear industry was actually shocked a few months ago, when the first reactor being built in Western Europe for two decades in Finland was actually running well over budget and causing financial losses for the French builder Areva. So this highly developed company is actually not even capable of creating something to cost right now. So it's hard to conceive that the Australian industry as a total newcomer to nuclear power is going to do better than the largest and most experienced builders in the world. And these builders are struggling to get one large project off the ground. So it's a bit scary when you think about it. The experts don't know what they're doing, and what's Australia going to do? The estimated costs for the eventual decommissioning of nuclear reactors have also blown out, and there's little experience of how much it costs to dispose of the highly radioactive waste from a nuclear reactor. I know a little bit about this because I used to live in New Jersey in America, and there's lots of nuclear plants over there, as the Simpsons often parodies, and one of them was Indian Point, and this is a very old reactor. And what I found when I worked for an environmental group over there was that the nuclear waste from this reactor has never been transported from the site that it was actually created. That's because there's such political anxiety going on that no politician will allow any truck with nuclear waste to move across the state highways. So this is actually a sort of amusing, sort of in a terrifying way, story about the United States. They have a lot of nuclear reactors. I don't know the exact figure, but most states in the US have nuclear reactors, and none of them have been allowed to ship their nuclear waste away from the reactor itself. So not only do you have the reactors chugging away, and they're often very old, and they often are poorly maintained, and they get away with flouting regulations, and regulations are fairly poorly, you know, people are very poor at going and fixing these problems, so they're always covering them up. So the reactors themselves are often very, very old. The waste is just collecting around them. And so if there was some form of attempt by terrorists or anyone to cause enormous destruction in the US, if they targeted these nuclear reactors, you would get this dirty radioactive waste that would be able to be blown out. And currently at Indian Point, there's 50 million Americans within the radius of, if they had a blow up there, 50 million people could be affected in a devastating fashion. So that's the United States, and surely, you know, they're supposed to be the leaders and technological experts, and even, you know, and they're pretty pro nuclear power. I mean, you know, Americans are pretty happy with their nuclear stuff for the most part. Even in that political climate, they can't transport their own nuclear waste. So let's jump back to Australia for a moment and look at how many people are against nuclear anything in Australia. I mean, I grew up and there were nuclear-free zones, like our streets and our suburbs would proudly proclaim that they had nothing to do with the nuclear world. So a completely different environment, a very anti-nuclear environment. What hope is there for our country in our current political climate, or the predicted political climate, for any real, you know, serious and effective dealing with any nuclear byproducts or even nuclear construction? We have no experts in nuclear technologies. One of the big problems is that we need to train an enormous number of people to deal with this new industry. We don't have anyone at the moment. So the training and education would be amazingly expensive. Then we've got the problem of maintaining these devices, and even the experts like the French or the Americans don't know how to decommission or get rid of the waste. So even if we could get over certain political hurdles, we don't even know if we have the science or the technology to deal with this stuff in a legitimate and environmentally friendly fashion. So it's all a bit concerning. Oh, I remember what the third point was now. Yeah, so the third point in favour of nuclear energy use in Australia is that, I didn't know this, but until recently, that uranium in the ground actually is radioactive. So you don't actually add any radioactivity when you take uranium out of the ground. So if people are worried about putting uranium back into the ground, they probably shouldn't be, because it'd be fairly easy, I think, if there was a program for it. Yeah, to, you know, take the nuclear waste and to distribute it sufficiently over a large area, you know, underground, that, you know, it wouldn't be a problem, or it would be doing the same things it was doing all along. Also, actually, nuclear reactors don't produce that much waste per year. The reason why American reactors can store all of their waste on site for 40 years is because there's actually very little produced per year. So don't think, if you think of a nuclear reactor, that there's going to be tons and tons of waste like there is from ordinary energy creation. There actually is a lot less than you'd think per year. And so one of the things about the nuclear power advocates is they're like, look, there isn't that much waste. It does save an enormous amount of the greenhouse gas emissions. So, and we have all the fuel right here in Australia. So, and we can bury it. There's a whole bunch of reasons. You know, the whole thing looks sort of neat if you look at it from that perspective. And it's only when you start getting into the nitty-gritty of implementation that you start to go, oh, I don't know, it looks a bit dodgy. So the British government's also having problems cleaning up their nuclear facilities, and there's just a bit of a problem thinking about how it's going to happen in Australia. And then you think, oh, our federal government's going to have to spend millions and millions of dollars actually trying to convince taxpayers to support anything that they decide on the nuclear energy situation. So if you look at last year, the Howard government spent $55 million to advertise its industrial relations changes. Imagine how much money they would spend per year on trying to convince Australians to accept nuclear power. So it's a really difficult issue. Nevertheless, it's still an issue, and there's quite a lot of discussion going on. So, for example, what would be one of the things that could happen to Queensland? You're a Queenslander living in Queensland or visiting Queensland. There's been suggestions that Townsville, Mackay, Rockhampton, Bundaberg, the Sunshine Coast, and Bribie Island have been named in the Australia Institute study in Canberra final list of 17 possible sites around Australia. So out of all the possible sites around Australia, 6 out of 17 are in Queensland, and specifically in southeast Queensland. I mean, that's amazing. And all of these places, look at this, Townsville, Mackay, Rockhampton, Bundaberg, Sunshine Coast, and Bribie Island. Well, Bribie Island, that's just up the road. That's an hour and a half away from the centre of Brisbane, and it's close to a lot of families, a lot of beautiful environment. I thought Bribie Island was protected. I thought we had a national park there or protect, you know, it's ads on the telly that claims that if you buy a house around there, there'll be these wonderful vegetative protected areas sort of for multiple generations forever. Well, where are they going to put this nuclear reactor? On Bribie Island? It's a little island, and it's our first surf beach going up the north coast. Do I want to surf near a nuclear reactor? I mean, wow, what's going on? What's this Australian Institute, and how are they getting to their decisions? And then let's look at some of the other suggestions. The Sunshine Coast. Oh, that's great. Yeah, let's see. Is that the best place of tourism in Australia? Maybe not. Maybe surfers paradise is slightly better. So let's dump it around Noosa or around that, you know, lovely area, Coolum. Who wants a nuclear reactor? Oh, yeah, we'll take one. Who's motivating these decisions? What are they trying to do? Is it employment? Are they like, oh, look, a lot of Queenslanders are out of work, so let's give them a couple of nuclear reactors? Doesn't seem likely to me. Seems likely to me that the people who are calling the shots in the political centres come from Melbourne or Sydney or Canberra, and they think Queensland's a great big dumping ground. That's what I'm feeling. So, you know, all of these beautiful places that have been suggested, it doesn't sound sensible to me. Look at Townsville. Townsville's one of the cyclone centres of Australia. We want to have nuclear reactors on the cyclone belt. Is this sensible? Australia doesn't have too much in the way of natural disasters, and yet the government's considering dumping our nuclear reactors right in the thick of an incredibly perilous situation, and a situation that environmentalists have suggested is going to get worse over the years with the greenhouse effect. So worse cyclones. Oh yeah, let's put a nuclear reactor there. Brilliant. Total points. Who are they asking for advice here? What's going on? Seems crazy. So very, very scary situation for Queensland, I think. Nevertheless, the research panel by the Institute suggests that 2/3 of Australians are opposed to having nuclear power, and certainly opposed to having nuclear power in their local area. So it's obviously going to be hard. It's going to be really, really hard to convince people to accept these things. I'm sure there will be protests in any of these towns. And if you feel strongly about these issues, I would encourage you to write to your local political representative, because I do think that it's too slack to wait until the next election before these issues get resolved. I think you need to have your voice heard every day if you can. Everything that you're interested in, you should write a letter, tell someone about it. Email's easy. Do it. So apparently this study says that it's the opposition to nuclear power is highest in middle-income households and among women. So women are concerned about nuclear power. I'm not surprised. The other thing is that it's probably going to take 20 years to institute these nuclear reactors. Given how anti-nuclear Australia is, it's going to create such bureaucratic hurdles to getting anything achieved. Almost that alone is a reason to not go to nuclear. Obviously, we've got uranium. I mean, it must be frustrating for people who like uranium to look at our lovely supplies and think, oh, why aren't we benefiting from it? I do have empathy for that. But why are they choosing sites like Bribie Island for their nuclear reactors? I need more information. Unfortunately, my news source has not given me any more information, so I'm stuck just looking at it and blinking like a deer in the headlights or something. And one of the things about this nuclear power debate is, amazingly, no one seems to be suggesting that we go for recycled energy, or at least a lot of the media doesn't seem to be covering that. And that seems like the most obvious thing to be looking at as an alternative to nuclear power. So obviously Australia has a lot of uranium, but we have a lot of opportunity for renewable energy. We have incredible amounts of solar energy, obviously, very, very hot country. One of the advantages of being the hottest country in the world is that we can utilise that solar energy for our benefit. And a team of Australians have just beaten the land speed record for solar energy, a solar car, and they averaged 70 kilometres an hour from Perth to Sydney. Very exciting. They cut this record by 5 days, and so that's a record that I think was established around 1996. So that's very exciting. Those are Australians, Australians going to university, the youth of today, working on technology for renewable energy. Very exciting. Why aren't we supporting that more? We've got, obviously, we have the minerals to make a lot of these electrical components. So why don't we continue to support the mining of the components required for solar panels and so forth, and start creating solar panels in Australia and selling them overseas and making everyone overseas amazed by our technology? One of the things I saw on the ABC's invention show was a contender for the first prize. It was a very simple device, and this guy had simply got his solar panel on the roof and then attached a big magnifying glass on top of it. It was amazing. I mean, I've used a magnifying glass as a small child. You just hold the magnifying glass over a leaf and you can create a fire. Very exciting if you're a kid. And this guy has sort of done that magnification of the sun's energy onto his solar panels, thus making them more efficient. What a wonderful idea. So clever, so easy, so cheap. Australia is a very smart country, and it's time we start recognising that and using what we do have available to us. Not only do we have solar power, but we've also got enormous opportunities for wind power. And there are some really great developments, actually, towns around Australia that are bringing wind power farms to their towns. And we're seeing that energy going to the main grid, and these towns not being reliant on coal-fired energy anymore. So that's exciting, and there's a lot of enthusiasm for that. So those are just two ways that Australian towns are improving their own effect on the greenhouse effect without having to go to nuclear. And maybe we should be emphasising those options and those alternatives in the media more than we're concentrating on the nuclear option, which seems fraught with difficulties on every level. You're listening to Planet Radio 88 FM. This is A Climate Affair, and I'm Kate Conroy with you this afternoon. It's time to take another deep breath, I think. It's 5:23 p.m. Almost the end of the day if you're working today. Almost time for dinner if you're at home. Almost time to be home if you're in transit and you're travelling from your place of work to your home. A deep breath will help you to relax and for you to feel comfortable right now. The amazing thing about breathing is you can do it even when you're stuck in traffic. You can take a deep breath when you're waiting for a bus. You can do 5 deep breaths and do an enormous amount of good without having to pay anyone or without having to be a member of a gym. You don't have to be wearing a certain kind of clothing to take a deep breath. And the brain will thank you for it. Because the brain, it utilizes its inspiration during an in-breath and then it relaxes during an out-breath. And the techniques of monks to perfect their breath is all about perfecting the length of your out-breath, because it is within the out-breath that your brain is most relaxed. And this is also why singing is so relaxing, because in singing you concentrate on your in-breath to be quick, and then you sing these long notes out. And that's why I think church choirs and Christian music can be so uplifting, because they've got all those amens, and those amens go for a long time. So you've got to be breathing out that entire time, and it's quite exhilarating, and I can understand why people feel closer to God when they sing them. So if you know how to do an om, you can sit in your car and you can make a little chant whilst you sit there and get a little rejuvenation in your day without anything at all. It's quite an amazing experience once you get the hang of it, and it's amazing how you feel that you're making the best of your life when you're able to take a minute to meditate and to breathe and to concentrate on enjoying the now and not worry about what's going to happen when you get home. I'm going to play us another song now. So let's go for some Ben Harper and Show Me a Little Shame. Oh yeah, Planet Radio, 88 FM. This is Kate Conroy and it's 5:29 p.m. on a Thursday afternoon. And you're listening to A Climate Affair. There's going to be a lot of opinions in this show. And if you're getting a little angry, I'm glad to hear it, you know. Bring it on, bring it on. We need some more debate. We need more debate that we can engage with. And we need debate about environmental issues, because these are the issues that are going to determine our futures and our livelihood and our children's futures. So let's focus on them and have a look and make a change and for the better. So far on the show, we've talked about recycled water, we've talked about nuclear energy, and now I'm going to get to my third topic for the night, and it's an interesting one, and it does tie in with the water issue, which is the ethics, I suppose, of what we eat and what choices we make in our diets. And what we eat is an interesting question, because not only does it have effects on our own health, but we have follow-on effects to the health of the animals that we are eating if we are eating meat. And obviously there are effects on the environment from the consequences of agriculture on the environment. All of these things come into play. So food is a very good place to begin if you're interested in changing your own lifestyle for the better, I think. I think we can all live a bit better for ourselves, and it will have follow-on effects for the environment. So it's a good way to go. So how does the food that we eat affect the environment that we live in? Well, the diet of traditional Australians, the meat and two veg diet, is one of the most costly of all agricultural processes. So, for example, if you eat a steak for dinner, that's going to use 40,000 litres of water in order to produce a single steak. Now, that water, of course, is not inside the steak itself. That water is what is utilised in order to grow the grain and the grass to feed the cows, and also the water required to feed the cows, and then the water required in order to process the cows in the abattoirs to then get the cows to you. Of course, there's also the cost of the fuel to get the cows to you. So meat is a very, very expensive proposition from every component of the economic scale. When you eat food that is meat, then you are contributing to the environmental crisis, quite literally. Nevertheless, of course, we're omnivores, and it's hard to give up a practice, especially if we've been brought up in that sort of diet, and if we have no idea how to make vegetarian food, or even how to make it taste good. I mean, I love food, so the idea of eating food that was not tasty, I think, is awful. And you might be a bit scared. You might think, well, I don't know how to balance my diet if I change to vegetarian food. Maybe I'll eat the wrong things and I'll have problems. And these are really important concerns. And if you've got a family and you've got children, then you've got to be very careful when you change your diet to make sure you are covering what you need nutritionally. But there's a couple of really easy things you can do that can make you help the environment and help your own health, which doesn't involve a complete revolution in what you're doing and how you're living. It's the approach that I like to be a part of, which is, you know, you don't have to give everything up. I think the extreme approach works for some people, but I think the subtle approach may be the more effective over the long term. People don't criticize people if they donate one day of their week to helping or volunteering or to charity. If you helped people on a Sunday and, you know, gave out meal packages to the homeless, no one would say to you, well, that's okay, I suppose, that you're helping these people one day a week, but why aren't you doing it every day of the week? What's wrong with you? People are usually very encouraging. They say, wow, one day a week, that's a pretty serious commitment. You know, that's cool, man. That's really good on you. You know, I wish I was doing something so important. So why is it when it comes to vegetarianism that people have to be pure vegetarians in order to be respected? Why is it that you can't be someone who tries to make a difference when they can, but nevertheless is not necessarily capable or strong enough to do it for the entire time that they're eating? For some reason, vegetarianism has become a very sort of almost sort of militaristic type of endeavor where you get judged when you go and eat at a party, or if you go home for Christmas, you've got a lot of the Christmas conversation seems to be about why you're not eating the turkey or the ham, and it can be very confrontational. So I'm a bit of someone who was a vegetarian, as in a strict vegetarian, for a number of years. And I found myself, very having to fight this fight about it that I didn't want to have to talk about. I just wanted to be living my life and making my choices, and I didn't want to have to justify it to everyone. And sometimes, you know, I would go to Christmas dinner and I'd think, yeah, you know what, maybe I will join in the group ceremony, the ritual of the meat. Maybe I can do that. So I sort of came around to perhaps meat in special occasions type of thinking, and I influenced my family to choose organic meat or free-range meat on the basis that one of the things that is important to vegetarians is often not necessarily the environmental effect, but of course that's very important as well, but the suffering of the animals that are, you know, utilized in Western meat-eating diets. The animals are often treated in appalling conditions, absolutely appalling. But people don't know about it. They just see the meat in the supermarket and they assume that there was ethical ways that it got there. They don't realize that the pigs are unable to move around in their stalls, that they're ripped away from their piglets, and that they are often, the sows are sort of stapled into their little cages and they're unable to turn around. They're on concrete floors. It's an incredibly artificial and horrifying environment. And if you think about pigs being as intelligent as dogs, if not more so, imagine your dog being stuck on a concrete block with their head stapled down so they can't move around, and their entire existence is just eating the food and excreting, and that they sit in their own excrement a lot of the time, and then they are carted off. Often they don't experience any sunlight. They certainly don't have any access to the external world. Any form of pleasure in their life is removed through these agricultural practices. Now, of course, they make perfect economic sense because you don't want your animals utilizing any calories. So the less exercise they are able to do, then the less you have to feed them. And pigs, you know, pigs put on a lot of weight very fast. They're one of the fastest of fat-growing, meat-growing animals. So the ratio there is very, very high, which is one of the reasons that they're kept in these appalling conditions. So pigs, chickens, they're treated pretty awfully. In Australia, our cattle are treated somewhat better than they are in the United States in a lot of spaces. But there's a lot of issues to do with these things that a lot of people just aren't even aware of. I mean, if you want to learn more about the way animals are treated, you can probably throw into Google animal rights and you'll come up with a lot of pages about it. So this is a huge issue. Nevertheless, it can be really hard, as I said, to be someone who just gives up everything that you're used to. So I think there's some pragmatic ways to deal with changing your lifestyle that will be really healthy for you and great for the environment. One of the things to realize is how good fresh nuts are, and fresh fruit and fresh vegetables, without any cooking, without any, you know, too much messing around. I'm not saying you should not use salad dressing or something like that, but to reconnect your taste buds to the taste of raw, flavorful food, a fresh strip of carrot is delicious. It's amazing. As long as you just reorient yourself, you don't need to slather it in cream cheese in order to enjoy it. And these foods, not only are they really tasty once you get into them, they're also absolutely jam-packed full of nutrients. They're so good for our bodies. They're so full of fiber. Nuts are so full of protein. They're full of good oils, omega-3s. Don't look for your supplements for omega-3s in a whole bunch of tablets. They exist in a whole bunch of things, and fruits, nuts, and vegetables are absolutely abundant sources. We really did evolve from the monkeys, I'm pretty sure of that. So if we did, we need to realize that our omnivore lifestyle probably stems mostly, our evolutionary past mostly stems from a hunter-gatherer stage, where most of the time we ate fruits and nuts from trees and we collected those things. And occasionally we probably did hunt and we probably ate meat. That's why we've got teeth the way they are, and our digestion can handle meat. So I'm not saying meat is unnatural. I'm merely saying that the proportion of meat in the average diet is clearly not the healthiest way to live. So even if you said to yourself, you know what, I think I could eat meat once a day. Instead of having a lunch with meat and a dinner with meat, maybe I could just have dinner with meat. Well, if you did that, you would be halving your meat consumption. Of course, it depends how much meat you had for lunch. But nevertheless, if you just replaced your ham sandwich with an avocado sandwich with salad, you would be making an enormous inroad to changing your approach to food. So there's a lot of small things you can do to institute a big change in the world that we live in. And I think thinking about small steps is the best way for long-term change. That's my thought on these matters anyway. So I hope you're having a good time. You're listening to Planet Radio 88 FM in Brisbane, and I'm Kate Conroy, and this is A Climate Affair, a show that's dedicated to talking about contemporary issues in the environment and in our world. And I hope you're having a wonderful afternoon. Planet 88 FM. You're listening to Kate Conroy, and this is A Climate Affair. We've only got 14 minutes left in the show, but I'm very excited because this is my first show and I'm enjoying myself. So that's a good sign, isn't it? I hope you're having fun too, and I hope you've had a stimulating afternoon thinking about what's happening in our state right now in terms of environmental issues. And I'd like to finish off with more discussion on what we eat and how it affects the environment. So not only is vegetarianism a better way on our water supply, oh, have I even talked about that yet? I don't think I have. Maybe I have. I said something about steak, I think, and that was 40,000 litres to eat a single steak. Certainly anything which is a raw vegetable is going to be less on – it's going to tax the environment less than anything that is meat. Certainly anything you don't have to cook is going to be better for the greenhouse effect because, of course, you don't need to use gas or electricity in order to create it. And there's so many great ways to have fresh food, especially being in Brisbane and in Queensland. So that gets me onto my second idea that I'd like to talk about. You may not have heard of this, but there's a movement going on that's begun in the United States, which is called locavores. Now, what's a locavore, you ask? Well, a locavore is someone who concentrates on eating local food. Local food is defined differently depending on your own perspective. But the general idea is that if your food comes from within a 100-mile radius, which is approximately 200 kilometres, a little less, then it's local. And local means that you don't need that many fuels to transport it. So it's a very, very good idea in the climate of global warming. The idea that Australians and certainly the Western world have, that they can go to a supermarket and eat any form of fruit or vegetable throughout the year, is a really unrealistic approach to food. Food is seasonal. You don't get certain types of food in the middle of winter in America, and yet if you go to a supermarket in Canada, you can buy peaches in the middle of winter that have been shipped from somewhere like Australia or somewhere in the southern hemisphere like Mexico. The cost of shipping these fruits and vegetables in terms of the fuel required to make them, to transport them, is enormous. There is so much energy devoted to shipping food around the world. So as a locavore, what does that mean in terms of choices that you make in your diet? Well, we are in a very lucky situation here in Brisbane because we have outdoor markets all year round. These outdoor markets are often supplied by local producers. And you can ask the people who run market stores, where does this food come from? Are you local? And you can find out how far away the food has had to travel in order to arrive in Brisbane. Foods that you probably already know are local are things like mangoes or macadamia nuts or pineapples. These things are sort of traditional Brisbane foods, and there's a reason why a lot of people, you know, they're famous and that everyone loves them here, which is fresh food tastes better. I've lived in Montreal, so I know what it's like to be somewhere where it's negative 20 degrees Celsius for 6 months of the year, and you're literally trapped in the cold. And in that environment, the supermarkets sometimes have fresh fruit and vegetables, but it tastes terrible. The pineapple that you could get in Montreal in the middle of winter was brown and often bitter, and it made you think, I just don't want to have to buy fruit anymore. I can't stand it. If I buy, and of course it's very expensive, so I would try to buy a melon. I think, oh, I've got to eat some fresh fruit. I'm so deficient in vitamins, I'm sure. So I would buy a honeydew melon, and that honeydew melon, I would take it home and I would cut it open, and the inside was rotten. There would be this sort of insipid brown liquid, which was the rotting fruit. And I thought, my goodness, I've spent, you know, $8 on this melon, and it's rotten. So like a good rat, I was discouraged, and I found myself unable to be a happy vegetarian in this environment because I couldn't eat the fresh foods that made vegetarianism so easy. So I found myself craving, I suppose, meat and cheese, which is what a sort of traditional Montreal diet is all about. And I suddenly understood why you get certain culinary traditions in certain cultures. The Swiss eat a lot of cheese because that's what they can maintain through the winter months when it's so snowy and cold outside. You can create all sorts of dairy products that will last through the winter, and they obviously provide quite a lot of nutritional value, and I can understand it in those circumstances. For some reason, the freezing cold makes you crave a different sort of food, and obviously it's very hard to get the sort of food that you might find in a California year-round or in Australia year-round. So that's Montreal, that's Canada, that's another place altogether. Here we are in Brisbane, and what do we have available to us? We have an enormous range of food. We have markets, and we have ways of including those foods in our diet. One of the ways to become more of a locavore is to think more broadly and more laterally from the food that we were taught to cook when we were young. So instead of cooking British food, which is what a lot of, at least white Australians, and I am being very white in my approach to things, and I will absolutely admit that I come from this sort of Irish heritage, and, you know, meat and potatoes is where I come from. And I know that a lot of Australians don't come from that tradition, and I certainly want to emphasize, I don't mean to be so focused on my own culture any more than I just only know my own culture better than others. But in terms of food, we really are part of Southeast Asia. And I love cooking Indian food, and I love cooking Southeast Asian food, partly because it tastes so delicious and it's so nutritious and it's so easy to make vegetarian food in those different cuisines. But also, they understand what it is to use ingredients that are easy to get in Brisbane. So let's take the humble mango, for example. Well, mangoes you can use in stir fries. You can make a chutney, a fresh mango chutney, for an Indian dinner. You can utilize mango in salads. You can utilize them in hot foods. There are so many ways in those different types of cuisines to incorporate nuts and fruits and vegetables that are easy to obtain around this area. So rather than looking at your old-fashioned recipe book that requires you to have these sort of strange English ingredients, then maybe you should think, well, let's adapt, let's change. I'm going to feed my kids something that's nutritious and made in harmony with my environment and close to home, which will make us all have a better future. And it's exciting, because why shouldn't Brisbane have its own cuisine, its regional cuisine, that is utilizing the ingredients that we actually can source close to here? One of my favorite drinks, I think, is the Bundaberg Dark and Stormy. I love the fresh ginger that they put in it, and I love the rum, and it's all pretty local. So it's good value for money. It's a tasty drink. It's got real ginger in it, as I said, so it's not all bad for you. And we're supporting our economy as well. So it seems like a win-win-win situation to me. And I think it's going to be a great future if we take on a little of this locavore philosophy. And the best thing about locavorism is that you can be a locavore, and it doesn't seem to have the same difficult connotations that vegetarianism entails. So you can say you're a locavore and people are interested, but they don't seem quite as judgmental. And they understand that sometimes, obviously, we can't be entirely local, for clearly it's going to be hard to source some of the things that we find very important in our cuisine. It'd be hard to make meals if we couldn't access, say, I don't know what isn't local in Brisbane. I'm fairly new here, but let's suppose that olive oil we need to get from South Australia, or salt. Oh, obviously, salt we can get locally, but there are a number of additives, say saffron or cumin or coriander. Maybe these things we do have to import some of from other places. That's okay. That's okay. You don't have to do 100%, even if you only do a 10% increase in your responsibility to the earth today. That's going to be an incredible increase over a long period of time. So it's amazing what we can do to change our world. It's amazing how easy it is to cook a new meal that's a little bit more sensitive to the amount of water it uses or the amount of energy is required to create the product that we're involved with. And not only that, is it's better for our health. If we eat more vegetarian food, you'll find that your whole body seems to be more alive, and that with fresh and raw food, you are gaining so much. An apple is such a wonderful invention, and I'm sure that the old-fashioned maxim of an apple a day keeps the doctor away is one worth keeping in mind. Just watch kids as they wolf down fresh fruit and vegetables if you offer them to the kids in a free sort of way. Throw away the muesli bars that are full of fat and sugar. Chuck away all that refined stuff. You don't need it. We don't need it. Why are we paying for it? Why are we adapting this? Why are we taking on the Pop-Tart culture? There's no reason to do it. Doesn't mean you can't have an ice cream every now and again. It just means not having a systematically poor health in our children and in our own lives. And you won't need as much coffee, I can guarantee it. It'll be natural, natural, wonderful all the way. So that's it really for me for the day. I've gone through a lot of things today. There's been a lot of discussion. I've talked about our recycled water that's coming in, which is probably going to be a good thing, but if you're scared of it, then maybe it's time to look into that water tank situation. Apparently, there's a huge run on water tanks in Queensland right now. Some people are installing two or more in their homes just to avoid the recycled water. Well, I don't think recycled water is such a problem. I think it's probably going to taste better than the water we currently have. Nevertheless, if it encourages water tanks, I think it's a great thing. Even if there is a media hype about it, any form of substantial change to our lifestyles in terms of water usage, I think is a good thing right now. So we're changing our water. We're also changing the possibilities of power. And we've looked at nuclear power. And the fact of the matter is Australia probably isn't going to succeed, I think, in a realistic and sensible fashion with the nuclear power. But I'll be watching that debate with a close eye. And finally, I've talked a little bit about food and what we eat and how the choices we make do directly impact on the environmental impact, on the environment that we're gaining that food from. So hopefully you've learnt something today or made you think a little bit about the life that you're leading. I hope you've had a good one and I hope you get home safely and have a great week. I'll see you at 4 o'clock p.m. next Thursday evening for another episode of A Climate Affair. This is Kate Conroy. Thanks for being with us. You're on Planet Radio 88 FM.